It is Monday, October 17th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, the long-awaited battle to oust Islamic State militants from the Iraqi city of Mosul is on. Our regional correspondent tells us how it started. The U.S. and Britain warn of possible sanctions against Russia for its involvement in the Syrian civil war. We'll preview this week's final presidential debate between Republican and Democratic nominees Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. China takes another big step forward in its space program, and a new American documentary highlights the daily struggles of Syrian refugees in Jordan. It's all ahead on International Edition. Iraqi forces have launched a long-anticipated ground offensive to retake the northern city of Mosul from Islamic State militants. The military operation that began Monday is Iraq's largest since U.S. combat forces left the country 5 years ago. VOA correspondent Jamie Detmer has been reporting on the conflict from Turkey in recent months. He's now in the U.S. city of Annapolis, and I asked him a short while ago.
East of Mosul and south of Mosul, the Kurds have claimed that they've been making some progress already in some of those outlying villages. And that there'd been a heavy loss of life of ISIS fighters. In the south, there seems to be not so much progress by the Iraqi armed forces. They're facing kind of hit-and-run attacks as they try to advance forward. Obviously, they have massive advantage in terms of manpower. They far outnumber the Islamic State fighters, and they also have the advantage, particularly outside Mosul, of close air support by up to 100 coalition and Iraqi warplanes. Obviously, once they start fighting inside the urban center, that air power isn't so useful, can't be used. There's also been a pledge recently today by the Iraqi Prime Minister that they will avoid, once they're in the urban center, of artillery shelling in order to try to reduce the loss of civilian life.
Well, who exactly is taking part in this offensive against Mosul? I understand it's not just Iraqi soldiers, right?
Yeah, it's rather like Heinz Baked Beans 57 Varieties, an old brand. We have the Iraqi armed forces, which are mainly Shiite in terms of officers and of men. We have the Shiite voluntary militias, often called the popular mobilization units. We have Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. There are about 3,000 or so various coalition, many of them, hundreds of them, American military advisors who will be involved more in logistics, although there are some U.S. Special Forces people, we believe, on the front lines. And as well as that, we have a Sunni militia who've been trained by the Turks, who are also clamoring to take part in the liberation of Mosul. So it's quite a crew. There is a coordination center for the Kurdish fighters with the Iraqi armed forces. But one of the concerns of a lot of analysts and diplomatic observers is it's going to be hard to keep all of these groups moving in the same direction, coordinating well, and avoiding possible clashes between themselves. The Kurds claim that any land that they seize from ISIS will become part of Kurdistan. These statements have really irritated Baghdad. The Shiite militias have been threatening that they will be involved in fighting in the urban center, even though the Iraqi prime minister has publicly pledged that no Shiite militias will be inside in the urban center of the city, which is a Sunni-dominated city.
Okay, well, thank you very much to VOA correspondent Jamie Detmer for bringing us up to date on the situation in Mosul.
Thanks very much.
Russia says its forces and their Syrian government allies are preparing for an 8-hour humanitarian pause in the Syrian city of Aleppo. Speaking Monday, a Russian military official said the Russian and Syrian forces will observe the pause on October 20th to allow for the free passage of civilians and the evacuation of the sick and wounded. The United States and Britain say they are considering new economic sanctions against the Syrian and Russian governments because of attacks that have killed civilians in Aleppo. After a meeting with allies Sunday in London, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his British counterpart Boris Johnson acknowledged that there is no concrete plan on how to end the violence in Syria. VOA's Zlatan Sakhok reports.
Images of civilians, including babies, being pulled from the rubble after indiscriminate bombings of Aleppo have caused international outrage and calls for action to stop the carnage. But after meetings with Russia's foreign minister in Switzerland and allies in London, Kerry did not sound optimistic.
We had a number of new ideas put on the table. We're going to continue to work at this because no one has a right to just walk away and allow Aleppo to continue to be bombed without making every effort possible in order to stop it.
Kerry said that negotiations are the only action the U.S. and its allies can take at this time. He said the military involvement of additional foreign powers would make the situation in Syria even worse, and that in any case, European countries are not prepared to enter a war in Syria. But he warned Damascus and Moscow that even a complete destruction of Aleppo would not eliminate the opposition.
Because other countries will continue to support opposition, and they will continue to create more terrorists, and Syria will be the victim in the end, as well as the region.
Johnson said the real answer on how to end what he called the slaughter in Aleppo lies with the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and its allies Russia and Iran.
It's really up to them now to listen and to show mercy to those people in that city, get that ceasefire going, get the negotiations going in Geneva, and let's bring this slaughter to an end.
He also said that perpetrators of war crimes in Aleppo will not go unpunished.
There are a lot of measures that we're proposing to do with extra sanctions on the Syrian regime and their supporters, measures to bring those responsible for war crimes before the International Criminal Court. These things will eventually come to bite the perpetrators of these crimes. They should think about it now.
Kerry held talks with representatives of nine other nations on Sunday in London after meeting in Lausanne Saturday with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, United Nations Special Envoy for Syria Stefan de Mistura, and representatives of regional powers that have influence in Syria. He said the parties at that meeting reached a broad agreement on a desired outcome on ending conflict, but not on how to achieve it. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the top stories right now on voanews.com. Transparency activist group WikiLeaks says founder Julian Assange's internet link is severed by a state actor. Kremlin-funded TV network RT claims that Britain blocked all of its bank accounts. Two buses collide in Pakistan, killing 27 people and injuring scores of others. Malawian president's return from the United States prompts more speculation about his health. And North Korean missile tests reduce the prospects for a compromise with the South. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. Well, it's time now to check what's buzzing online, and International Edition's social media reporter G. Abby Lee is here to do just that. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So we have some positive news coming out of Nigeria for a change, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
What have you got on that?
So Boko Haram released 21 of nearly 300 girls the group kidnapped from Chibok last week, and the girls reunited with their families on Monday. The emotional reunion is captured on camera, and you can find it all over social media. CNN's Aisha Sase is tweeting from the location, and here's an example. Just spoken to a Chibok mother whose girl wasn't freed. She has learned her daughter was married off and now has a child. Hashtag bring back our girls. Sase describes herself as a child of Africa, and her handle is at Aisha Sase CNN.
So that Bring Back Our Girls campaign is still definitely going on.
That's right. We still have more than 200 girls left to be rescued.
Right. So what else is trending today?
Let's talk about technology. So Tesla was supposed to unveil a new product Monday, but pushed the announcement to Wednesday.
And Tesla is that automaker, right?
That's right. And they also have energy storage products, and it's best known for electric cars. People are talking about the delay because it's not the first time Tesla pushed back its announcement. More than a week ago, its CEO Elon Musk tweeted, "The company will unveil a product without specifying what that is." And on Sunday, he tweeted, "The announcement will be pushed back to Wednesday because they need a few more days of refinement."
What's the social media reaction like to that revelation?
Well, as you can imagine, the overriding sentiment is that of disappointment, but some Tesla fans are tweeting that even though Musk never really hits a deadline, he always gets it right. Other people are joking. He's straight up tweeting work emails. But I kind of like the fact that we get these updates from the company via Twitter, but that could be just the millennial in me.
Well, I think people do generally like transparency. Mm-hmm. But thanks very much, G. That's all the time we have for today. You can follow G on Twitter at G Abby Lee, and the show is there too at VOA_IE. Well, we're just 2 days away from the final U.S. presidential debate between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton in Las Vegas, Nevada. Ellis Hennekin is a former columnist for U.S. news site Newsday and a political commentator. International Edition's Lori London spoke to him on the phone and asked him what he expects to happen in Vegas.
I guess we should look at history. Listen, history, please. Donald seems to be inching more and more in the direction of trying to undermine the legitimacy of the vote. Talking about the election being rigged, unclear frauds that are being perpetrated, about global conspiracies. And I guess we're likely to get a lot of that, a lot of media bias allegations, a lot of comments about some of the folks who stepped forward and made accusations. Clinton, I think, is likely to want to deflect most of that. Again, I don't think there are a lot more people that she can convince that Donald Trump is unfit. So I would suspect that we will see her pivot more in the direction of trying to make the case about her vision as president, trying to reach out to millennials, to Bernie Sanders voters, to nervous Republicans, to people that she might be able to get to if she can just give them a reason. Not that Donald Trump is bad, but that the Hillary Clinton vision is something that they can get behind. It really is time for her to do that.
Is there any way he can turn anything around at this point?
Yeah. I mean, she can mess up badly. He can somehow or another get back to the things that I think are the growth potential for him. Tapping into that feeling of anxiety out there, the middle class angst that spreads across America. You know, there are a lot of people who are not very happy with the direction the country's going. And Hillary Clinton is not the perfect candidate. So the tragedy from the Trump point of view, I guess, is that that potentially winning message has gotten sidetracked on the way to all this craziness. And, you know, maybe it's not too late for him to veer back in that direction, especially if she does something really dumb.
You mentioned Donald Trump talking about a rigged election. He's really ramping up that allegation, regardless of the fact that there is no proof to substantiate that other than he's not doing well in the polls. How worrisome are those kinds of accusations?
You know, it's interesting because it hasn't even been fully clear what he means by rigged. We used to think that meant that somehow something was explicitly being stolen through some dirty technique. What he seems to be focusing on really is, as you say, bad poll numbers and negative stories in the media. Most of the rigging, apparently, constitutes interviews with women who claims that he treated them in a bad way, or stories about other things that are unflattering. Listen, negative campaigning has always been part of this game, and both sides play it effectively. We've not had a candidate, though, at least not in modern times, who has called so directly into question the very mechanism by which we elect presidents and peacefully transfer power from one side to the next. And I think it leaves the country in kind of a dark spot if there are those 35 or 40% of people who think the whole thing was a fraud.
And that was U.S. political commentator Ellis Hennekin in conversation with my colleague Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The International Diabetes Foundation predicts that 1 in 10 people will have diabetes by 2040. Treatment for diabetes can include 1 or 2 painful injections of the hormone insulin every day. Scientists at Niagara University say they've developed an ideal transport system that can withstand some of the harsh environments of the human body and effectively deliver insulin where it needs to go without the need for those painful shots. The insulin is contained in a small capsule made of naturally produced lipid molecules or fatty acids. The researchers found the capsules can travel undamaged through the digestive system, and then cells in the bloodstream take them in and release the insulin. The researchers presented their findings at the 252nd National Meeting and Exposition of the American Chemical Society in Philadelphia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Two Chinese astronauts are heading to an orbiting space laboratory as part of China's preparations to eventually deploy a permanent manned space station by 2022. The astronauts' Shenzhou 11 spacecraft blasted off on Monday on a Long March rocket. It's expected to rendezvous with the Tiangong 2 space lab on Wednesday. Their one-month stay will be the longest in space by Chinese astronauts. Independent Australian space analyst Maurice Jones told VOA's Victor Beattie the astronauts will use that time to conduct experiments and test systems for a Chinese space station's core module.
The Tiangong 2 laboratory won't have anything to do with the final space station. It won't be a part of it. And China will launch a special module in around 2018 that will serve as the core of that new space station. The main goal of Tiangong 2 is to practice the techniques and the technologies that they'll be using to build and operate that final space station.
Do you have any idea how many manned missions it will take to finally construct this?
I think a lot of the construction will be taking place automatically, which is a bit different from the way a lot of the International Space Station was constructed. They'll simply fly up a module and automatically dock it with another module, which is very similar to the way the Russians constructed their own early space stations. Nevertheless, there will be some parts, such as I think some of the solar panel deployments, where they will definitely need astronauts on board to help with the construction, and they'll have robot arms to do it as well as spacewalks.
And when will this permanent station be finally manned?
We expect that the space station will be complete around 2022, and around about that time is when they'll probably start permanently occupying it with astronauts. That being said, there will be crews going up to it well before its construction is finished, but it won't be permanently occupied at that stage.
Well, China began its first crewed space mission back in 2003. How many missions have they conducted so far?
This is the sixth time that they have launched astronauts into space. So they tend to space out the missions over a fairly long interval. And they try to do as many new things as they can with each launch. So they're getting a lot of sort of cost efficiency out of the way that they run their astronaut program.
Is this orbiting laboratory going to be similar to the International Space Station currently in orbit?
No, the International Space Station is very large and very complicated. And China will have a fairly impressive space station, but it will be a great deal less than the International Space Station. It will have less than half its volume and a lot less complexity. But considering the fact that this is China's first ever space station, it's quite an impressive achievement.
Australian space analyst Maurice Jones also says China hopes to eventually internationalize its space program to include non-Chinese astronauts. Well, there are around 80,000 people living in Jordan's Za'atari refugee camp. For 1 month, that number included American documentary filmmaker Chris Temple and fellow producer Zach Ingrassi. Setting up tent in the middle of the camp, the Americans meant to experience, along with the Syrian refugees there, how it feels to live in diaspora. Their goal was to communicate the refugees' day-to-day interactions with the rest of the world. And the result is a documentary called Salam Neighbor. VOA's Penelope Pulu tells us about it.
District 5 is going to be your temporary home.
This was the first time that Chris Temple and his co-producer were visiting the Middle East.
So when we arrived in that camp, we were really nervous until the second we start setting up our tent, all of these refugee families started pouring out of the tents next to us.
Chris Temple told VOA he made this film to dispel this prejudice.
The population that's bearing the biggest burden and fear around terrorist attacks, you know, are refugee populations, are Arab populations and Muslim populations in this region. This isn't, you know, a Muslim versus Christian attack. And imagine being a family inside of Syria right now, where you're stuck between Assad and a group like ISIS.
Salam Neighbor features a number of Syrians, mostly from middle-class families, who fled their country. One of them is 11-year-old Rauf, who suffers from PTSD from bombings near his house. Despite Zaatari's seeming safety, 11 kilometers from the war zone, bombings still rock the camp.
Well, what did Rauf do wrong? You know, he's a young 11-year-old boy, and in many ways, this refugee crisis, especially the Syrian refugee crisis, is one of women and children. You know, 75% are women and children of the 4.8 million refugees.
Chris Temple hopes his documentary will help open hearts and minds about the millions of Syrian refugees stranded in countries such as Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Greece.
I think that one of the biggest myths about refugees is that they're assumed to be burdens. You have doctors, you have lawyers. Ghassoun, one of the people in our film, was a nurse back in Syria. So they have so much they could productively contribute to their whatever new country they're going to.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Dan Crafton. I'm Michael Lippin. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Michael_Lippin, and I'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we have a page called VOA Now. That's all for today. I hope you have a great week ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To anyone interested in living and working in the United States, October means the beginning of the entry period for the Diversity Visa Program, sometimes informally known as the Green Card Lottery. This year, the window for submitting applications for the 2018 program opened on the morning of October 4, 2016, and will close on November 7, 2016, at 7 o'clock in the morning, Greenwich Mean Time. The United States is a nation of immigrants and continues to welcome those who want to make the United States of America their home. Throughout our history, groups of immigrants have made unique contributions to life in the United States. Without this diversity, we would not be the nation that we are today. Nonetheless, not all groups are well represented in our country. The Diversity Visa Program helps address that deficit. Through the Diversity Visa Program, every year, the United States makes available up to 50,000 immigrant visas to people who are interested in living in the United States. If your entry is selected, you may have the opportunity to apply for an immigrant visa to allow you to move to the United States. You can also include your spouse and unmarried children under the age of 21 in your entry. If you are interested, please take note of this web address, www.dvlottery.state.gov. Here you will find all the information you need to enter the 2018 Diversity Visa Program, including eligibility requirements, directions on how to enter, and the application itself. Beginning May 2, 2017, you can return to this website to view the status of your entry. Keep your confirmation number until at least September 30, 2018. Please remember that all applications must be submitted electronically and no paper applications can be considered. You must also include a photo taken within the last 6 months. Do not reuse a photo from previous years. Enter only once, as submitting more than one entry will disqualify you. All selectees are chosen by a random drawing. Make sure you use your own email address to apply. The entry process is free and it is easy. Beware of anyone who offers to expedite your entry for a fee. Also, make sure you keep your confirmation number and use an email address that you will have access to throughout the end of the DV program. Keeping the confirmation number and using a personal email address will help protect you from scammers. Once again, entering the lottery is free and easy. Just go to www.dvlottery.state.gov. Good luck.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.